going to go ahead and start doing a Q&A, question and answer section. I am going to start us off by asking a question real quick, and then we'll pass it on to the audience. We've got a mic that we're going to pass around, because unfortunately not everyone is quite as good as projecting as you are. I'm actually going to start off by asking you guys a question about questions, which you both talked a bit about. One thing that I was really, I'm going to premise it by saying something my teacher in fourth grade, which has stuck with me, something she said something that stuck with me for literally my whole entire life, that we should always strive to be students by having an open mind and wanting to learn more about the world that we're in and the context that we're in. Talking about the idea of being a good Samaritan, turning the question around, or the complexity of ethics and understanding how to create our own ethical system, reproductive justice is complicated, and it is a current act of revolution and devolution at the same time. So I wonder, what are some of the questions that you think we should be asking as people who are working in the reproductive justice field, trying to navigate the complexities of ethics and how do we engage in this in a positive way without, you know, burning ourselves out, or, you know, how do we include all of the people that maybe sometimes we're not aware enough to think about including? Just some of those questions that we could ask as young professionals or old professionals or students. Does that kind of make sense? I'm rambling up. My apologies. either of you, and then we'll pass it on.
Beautiful
moment.
Wow. So whenever I'm asked, what can I do? It's always a weird question for me. And it, a lot of times it's based on who's asking me that question. I can simply say that what I challenge people on, what I make sure we do in Women with a Vision is, if you're in an environment, and that's any environment, and you feel like people just don't get it, like some of the things we do on a more serious side at Women with a Vision is we have a reading list, and we add to that reading list constantly. There is no one that can work at Women with a Vision if you can't go through my reading list. I don't care how you read it. I don't care when you read it. Sometimes I may not care according to the book if you skim it. But I also feel like in the 10 years I've been Women with a Vision's executive director, if it is my responsibility to lead this organization in the future and make sure that it lasts and make sure that the mission is honored, is that I can put in place policies at Women with a Vision to ensure that I'm hiring the same kind of people. Or if we're not hiring the same kind of people, how do we bring in people who are close to thinking like we are and willing to go the distance, right? Something so simple as a policy. People, like, we see people every day that won't walk into somebody's clinic. They're not going. I'm not going over there. I don't go by those people because of the way they treat me. If you are a person and you work in a place and you know people are being treated less than they should be, and people are made to feel shame and stigma for public health students, y'all ought to know. Shame and stigma is the reason we have half of the communicable diseases we have. But it's used for everything. It's used around abortion. It's used if you were poor. It's used if you grew up here. But I tell people, if you walk in your office every day and some people say, well, I'm just a social worker, I'm just a case manager, I'm just the program manager, it's still your job to challenge them. I know we have to eat. Even if it says, if you go to somebody and say, hey, can we do better about how we treat people? Can we hold an in-service? You know, like, I want to use that as a minute to just talk about how we treat people. We want to treat people. How do you want to be treated when you walk in somebody's door? And all of us carry bias. And I say it all the time. I've said it with an employee I got rid of at Women with a Vision. You know, if you could sit in a meeting with me and say, well, you see, those people, first of all, anybody in my office that say these people, you're out. First of all, I don't know who would say that to me and feel okay with it. But it really is about the small. Sometimes people think it's these big old things you have to do. Sometimes it's the little things. How do we treat each other? How do we help change policy in our current agencies or at our school? I always challenge when people hold stuff at Tulane, I challenge them. I was like, hey, did y'all figure out a way to make it accessible for community? Oh, they won't come. How do you know? Did you ask them? So anything that you can do that, and I don't know if I'm answering your question. I felt like your question was so big. But anything you can do to offer help. And when I say that, it means, you know, and I'm going to say this as a quick example because it came to mind. So last year during the elections, everybody was like, oh, you see what happened to Elizabeth Warren in Texas? because women didn't vote. And automatically, news stations started caring, because see, the black vote didn't follow through. And you see, black women didn't vote. And so all my people in my camp around the country went hard. They were like, ah. 95% of women who voted were black women who voted in Texas. They didn't stay home. And so then the conversation becomes, white women, could you vote the way you're supposed to sometimes? Stop voting the wrong way because you think it goes with your values. Stop voting the wrong way because you think you're safe with somebody. Small things for people who are in public health or social work is the last thing I'm going to say. If you see a law saying they're going to test drug users and they can go to jail or they can lose their kids, you shouldn't have a license. Because you should know as a professional that what they needed was treatment, not jail. Those are like simple things that come up for me.
I think you should, if you're questioning about what your role is, you should always have more questions of yourself than you have of others or of the situation. You should be questioning, if you're looking at an oppressive situation, even though you feel remote from it, you should ask, what is my role in the oppression? You should be asking yourself, where are my blind spots? Because I think if you ask questions of yourself, there's the problem of not knowing, but I think it's far more problematic to not know that you don't know. And I think there are things where we have blind spots around. So I think most of the questions that you should have should be of yourself. The Mahatma Gandhi once said, you know, when I look at others, I look for God in others. I only look for the devil in myself. So the whole notion of when you be most suspicious of your own motive rather than the motives of others, and ask yourself the kind of questions that will demand accountability of yourself. And the integrity will start at home, and then you could demand accountability of someone else. So I think in our quest to do good, to do right, sometimes we rush to do before we figure out what to do. And so I'm not talking about analysis paralysis. I'm not talking about, am I racist? Is this racist? You know, I'm talking about asking yourself those kind of, if you're an intuitive person or seek to become more intuitive, and examine your own motives. Examine what this is about for you. One of the things I've seen, that there are some people who bird dog on my Facebook page. When I write, 300 people will like or write or leave. But there are a few people who know me from way back in the day. There are people who will celebrate me to no end as a feminist and as a man who stands up for the rights of women and for reproductive rights. But when I offer from my racial analysis, because I'm no longer poor, people expect me to substitute class analysis for race analysis. I don't care how much money I have, and I don't have a lot, but however much money I have, it never protects me from the racism in this society. So I wonder about the people who rush in to explain away my understanding of my experience when I say something is racist. Oh, that wasn't racist, that was a, you know, a guy that I've known jumped in, and because I made an endorsement of Black Lives Matter, he jumped in with All Lives Matter, and I told him what was problematic about that, and he ultimately disclosed that he didn't hear or find himself in the Black Lives Matter because he was a white guy. Right? And so the question that I'm getting at that you should always have of yourself, if you feel this need to self-vindicate every time there is some issue that comes up, ask yourself, what is that about for me? Why do I have a need to extract myself out of the system of oppression? And why do I feel indicted when, because I have a characteristic that's common with an oppressor? You know, there are people who question, and I was having a conversation with the person who picked me up, people say, am I an ally? Am I a feminist? You know, and so people are trying to figure out what is my stake in the game, right? And I ask those people the question, for people where my gender is the problem versus patriarchy, for people where you know, being gay is the problem versus homophobia, for people where any of those systems that we see to oppress others, the first question you have to ask is, what is this about for me? And I think the more questions you have of yourself, it will challenge you to go to a place of integrity, and then that better situates you to work on whatever issue it is you care about. I think reproductive justice has the ability to demand integrity from you about the issues that you care about.
Thank you.
I actually had a question for Ms. Haywood. Is there anywhere online accessible, because I'm sure others here are wondering, your reading list for Women with a Vision, because I'd love to read some of that.
Yeah, so this summer we posted the summer, I think it was the summer, yeah, they say yes. The summer reading list. It was all over Facebook. I'm sure it's on our website. And we're supposed to be doing a new one for winter. That lady right there. It's going to be pulling it together. Any information about the organization is on our website. I think it's listed in the information. If not, it's wwav-no.org. And normally we entertain questions through our Facebook page or our website. If it's not too much, if it's too much, I'm not answering it. And when I say that, meaning like there's just some things there's no way to answer in a Facebook message or anything like that. The one thing we did do this week, we just hired a sexual health and reproductive, whatever the girl's title we hired this week. We're going to try to do more in the community that will be open.
I have a friend who's a social worker, and she works at a crisis pregnancy center. And I feel like what she may be doing is kind of ethically wrong. But I also think it's ethically wrong to not have that conversation with her about her work. And I feel like ethically we're not even on the different pages, we're like reading different books, and I don't know what to do about that. And I know it's important, but I'm not really sure how to have that productive conversation. And I don't like the idea of forming, sometimes and with this movement, it can feel like an us versus them kind of thing, and that makes me sort of like uncomfortable because I don't know what that gets. So I just wanted to hear your comments about sort of how you would approach that situation.
Well, I think first you have to have an air of mutual respect, and you have to do what you need to do to create that air of mutual respect. So, somebody said, we'll all think alike, not think too much, right? So it's not about groupthink or trying to get this person to, it's not about the art of persuasion. And the proselytizing that other people do, even those of us who think we're clear-headed and we are respect the autonomy of women, it's not about proselytizing somebody to your side of you. It's more about what the Mahatma Gandhi, he said that honest disagreement can be the beginning of progress. Possibly, to the degree that you're vested in that person and their well-being, if you all have an authentic relationship where you all can honestly disagree, the social capital of that relationship may allow you the opportunity to give her other things to think about. Because it's the insularity of surrounding yourself in the echo chamber of people who think just like you. And if you don't ever have an opportunity to think about something in a different way, there's no way to break out of that echo chamber. And that's part of the reason why I'm public about my own religious beliefs and the role that it plays in my decision to do this. Religion is very private. Spirituality is very private. And it's not a tactic or a strategy for me to say that I'm a Christian and I do abortions just to push back on the antis. That's my authentic reality and the way I view and see the world. That's where my motivations come from. And the purpose of me being public about that is to pose a counter-narrative. Because the people who terrorize women and others because they have a certain religious understanding, they are validated in that there's no counter-narrative. There's no opposing voice. So maybe I would say my advice to you with this person that is problematic for you, that she is engaged in a subtle form of coercion and tyrannizing folk who are in a very vulnerable place as they make a decision, that you can talk to her and give her another way of thinking. And that requires a commitment to the relationship, because somebody said that closed minds are like doors. The harder you push on them from the outside, the more firmly they become closed. So I think it may be a long, it might require a long-term investment, and I wouldn't necessarily think that there's going to be a magical conversation that you can have with her that's going to change her mind. But I would say if you're going to have a chance at all, to the degree that you care about what she thinks and what she's doing, is investing in a relationship, impose a counter-narrative. If you don't agree with her, in the context of that relationship, give her something else to think about. And be okay if she doesn't, but because the progress will be with honest disagreement. It's not about seducing her to think your way. It's about understanding where she's coming from, and that requires listening. And then maybe you'll hear the fatal flaw in her thinking that you can talk to her about.
All right. Well, I grew up in Hattiesburg, and so I know kind of what it's like to be a pro-choice feminist in Mississippi. And I recently heard that the abortion clinic in Jackson was broken into and vandalized. How is that, has that changed the way that your clinic is structuring? Are you just going to replace the cameras, or is it a more serious, you know, violation, invasion for you and your patients and your staff?
Well, it's an act of domestic terrorism. It happened back in March, and the intent of, you know, it's like the intimate partner or abuser, or when they put a hole in the wall, what's implied is that could be your head, right? And so I think the whole notion of doing destruction, besides consuming resources, is the whole fungibility argument. It's like, if I tear up your clinic, you got to spend money repairing it. That's money that you don't have to conduct services. I was interviewed, and I said that, you know, this was an act of domestic terrorism, and then somebody smugly said that doctor needs to learn the difference between vandalism and terrorism. Well, vandalism isn't about sending a message to you that next time it could be you. It's about terrorism. So it's, what do? You don't validate that. What we did was we had to... Our thoughts weren't, oh, how tragic it is that somebody came down in a hazmat suit and broke the cameras, or damaged, did $50,000 worth of damage to a generator that you're just obligated to have by law as a backup power system, even though the whole electric grid in Jackson would have to go out to need that generator. But because of the laws around abortion, you could not do services with that generator impaired. We had to rapidly get that generator fixed. But the goal was... It wasn't, staff didn't feel vulnerable. They were just frustrated with the fact that somebody was, you know, that for, there's no ethics, as we talked about earlier. There's no, they go by a principle of by any means necessary. They allow their end to justify the means versus you can't, there's no right way to do the wrong thing. They figure out all the time the right way to do the wrong thing. So, the implications of that was you have to kind of say, we're in it for the long run. We understand what that's about. And it's like you have to regroup, pick up, and get back at it. Somebody pushes you down, you have to get back up. So that was our take on, you know, the vandalism and the domestic terrorism that, you know, you got to come harder than that.
I'm a medical student, and I want to be an abortion provider. So this is a little bit of a specific question. What advice would you have for me and maybe my colleagues in medical school who want to do this work up and coming now in the current climate? What can we do to be most effective? And for my colleagues who maybe don't want to be providers, what can they be doing to, as future physicians, to sort of, you know, show their support? Specifically as a person working in the medical field?
Well, first, I think as, you know, you've chosen your medical school, I think the more critical piece is where you do your... There's not a whole lot of hands-on in medical school, so probably you'll be the rare student that gets to get some hands-on experience in abortion clinic. But, you know, once you make your decision that this is healthcare and that should be a part of your core competency as a physician, you have to insist that that training be available to you. So you almost have to take a consumer-based approach. So you want to jam out medical school so that you'll have your pick of places where you can train. And so then when you go and you interview, you'll have to say, I'm interested in being a comprehensive reproductive health provider. For me, that includes abortion. Do you offer abortion training? So it's a demand. Medical schools that want to compete for you as someone who's ultimately maybe their stellar award-winning Nobel laureate and say that you went through their school, that's what they do. They kind of like, oh, we want the best of the best, right? That notion. And so if they understand that the place that you pick as a essential criteria has to provide you with competency in abortion care, they will need the demand if they want to compete. For the people who don't want to technically provide abortions, they have to... it's kind of being taken out of their hands in terms of the regulations around the content of graduate medical education is requiring that everybody have that abortion training as a core competency. And so rather than seeking it out and opting in, you have to opt out. So increasingly, people who graduate will be required to train to competency, and you will have to establish a conscientious objective profile. It won't just be, oh, I don't want to do abortion, so I'm going to go to the library and read. No, you will do history and physicals, and you will be accountable for the same knowledge base, even if you don't do the procedure. So people are being made to understand that I'm not a cardiologist, but I know how to use a stethoscope. Right? My colleagues, we used to get called to the ER. Once people didn't go into gynecology, they forgot how to do a speculum. They forgot how to do a bimanual exam. And so we'd say, they'd call us down to the ER to rule in femininity, right? And you didn't forget everything you learned in medical school just because you're now choosing not to deal with women. So there's what I call core medical knowledge. You never lose that core knowledge. And now we're insisting that abortion care is core competency knowledge. So you have to, as a consumer of that education at the next level, demand that that educational content be available to you. And your colleagues have to understand that they should not be comfortable having blind spots in their medical education.
I have two questions. The first one is thinking about rape culture or rapist culture, as Roxane Gay has called it, which I like better, and just general systems of oppression. Where do you think that this victim blaming in our culture comes from? Why is it so often a knee-jerk reaction for people? And wondering if you had any theories about that. My second question is that, Dr. Parker, you talked a lot about how there's no right way to do the wrong thing. Something that I struggle with is there a wrong way to do the right thing? And if you have any insight on that.
So when I think about, you said, like, where does this shame come from? It would take us, we would leave a history class for that. But when you think about the shaming of women, it's been since the beginning of time. The shaming of women. My father is a Pentecostal minister. I'm a lesbian. You know the story. So I don't know if I consider myself a very spiritual person, but I'm not a very religious person. But, I grew up listening, like so many people, like it kind of started in, for a lot of people who believe in the whole concept of Adam and Eve, it started with Eve, It started with Eve, and that may sound so simple, but it's a story that's told, and it started all with her not listening, right? In the work that we do with sex workers, our formerly incarcerated women, we often talk about like how women have, again, since if we're thinking about what it looks like for Black women, we always think about slavery, and we think about the shaming and what that looks like, right? Part of my thing is it's like anything that makes people feel inferior is where shaming comes from, right? If I can make you, see, if you just didn't do this, if you just wouldn't wear that shirt, that's kind of too scoop-neck, too low, this wouldn't have happened. We use it against everything for everybody, right? So I think shaming is just a part of our culture. It's a part of our history. That's the only answer I have for it. And I think that's the same analysis we use at Women with a Vision when we are thinking about the work that we do for women. It's why when I opened up, I talked about, like, at Women with a Vision, I'm amazed by the number of people who need women to be a victim. You need to feel like they were hurt, forced, beat. You need to think the worst about them in order for you to help them. That's what, because for a lot of people, that's what makes people feel comfortable. It's like, well, she was beaten. This is why I do this work, because I don't want to see women get beat. Other than thinking like, well, she has a right, it's about human rights. You won't think of it like that. Or women involved in sex work, like right now the federal government puts all kind of money in trafficking, but they're not putting money in economics to uplift women. But people run. I'm going to go stop that. And I'm just to put it out there, when you think about that whole narrative, wherever I go, if it's something that's hot, a hot topic, I try to put it out there. But you know, we talk about the war on drugs and how people are really talking about the war on drugs and what it looks like to fight the war on drugs. Well, trafficking is the new war on drugs. And if you need more information about that, I think we posted some stuff on our website. But I just think shaming really comes from some from religion, some from just everyday people feel like, you know, you don't live like me. And I think the way that I live is the right way. So I shame people who don't. I live in Lakeview. I don't know why I'm making a Lakeview tonight. But, you know, I live in Lakeview versus I live in the Ninth Ward. Like, you deserve more. It's a way to separate people as well. Like, you deserve more if you live in this neighborhood, and you deserve less if you come from this area.
The other piece about the whole victim blaming is making people responsible for their own oppression. Like, was it Zora Neale Hurston said, if you don't raise your voice, people will kill you and then say that you enjoyed it. And, you know, the whole notion of, you know, it's kind of like the same way that our comfort with, one of the ways we pacify ourselves around the issue of race and racism, we have to make every racist be a Klan member, right? Because then we can, when we make it extreme, that's not who I see myself as. So then I don't have any responsibility in combating racism because I'm not a racist, because I'm not a Klan member. And men who, or people who victim blame women about rape, and it is like, you know, it's not about we live in a racist culture, and so what is, to what degree am I complicit because I don't insist on their on neutralizing the safety. You know, what it means for me to be able to walk down the street at 11:30 at night as a man, my responsibility is to figure out why can't you walk down the street at 11:30. So victim blaming, it means, I want to say, because you were on that street at 11:30, that's why you were raped. That absolves me of any responsibility to figure out what systems we are supporting that allow people to feel entitled to attack you. Even if you were walking on that street sans ropes, without clothes, right? That nobody has, your bodily integrity says nobody should touch you no matter how you're dressed, right? And so if I make you responsible for my behavior, then I abdicate my responsibility to participate in justice in the society. So I think that's what victim blaming is about. And kind of like with the whole Black Lives Matter, every time somebody gets shot down in the street, by the time they're done, you did something to make yourself eligible to be shot down in the street. The guy who was shot in Cincinnati 2 weeks earlier, I lived on that street where he was shot. I used to own a house there. I was there giving grand rounds at the University of Cincinnati. I drove down that street. So imagine when I thought about the fact that this guy had a crooked tag, and my tag is sometimes crooked because it's not bolted. A campus police officer who's 2 miles off campus stopped this man and then confronted him and then tried to get him to get out of the car, and he refused. And then as he's driving off, he shoots him in the head. And his body cam shows, but he says that the guy tried to run him down. But I'm saying that when you look at a person gets shot by the police every 2 days, right? How many police officers have been prosecuted for lethal force in a nonviolent, non-threatening situation? And what do we do? The first thing we do is we rationalize, because then we're saying that if Black folk just behave better, if you were more law-abiding, which rape, like the guy who threw this kid, this young girl across the room, and everybody's saying she was being bratty, right? When did the responsibility to be a professional in that situation fall to a child, right? So my point is, you know, the victim blaming is our way of leaving the status quo in place And it's our way of abdicating our responsibility to work towards the society that we want to see. Now, you asked a question of me specifically about what?
Doing the right thing in the wrong way.
Oh, well, I think Dion told us multiple ways in which you can do the right thing in the wrong way. In your effort to help, that's one of the things when I was at the CDC, the first thing they told us is never show up in a community and say, we're with the government and we're here to help, right? That's the wrong way to do the right thing. Even if you think people need help, if you're in a community, if you're coming to a table to offer an asset, there's a way in which you enter that community. So even though you mean well, if you're not respectful of the culture, of the situation, if you don't ask people how they want you to help, that's the wrong way to do the right thing, even though you're there and you mean well. So absolutely there. More often than not, we see well-meaning people doing it the wrong way.
I think whenever people think about the right or the wrong way, when you talk about shame, when you talk about victim blaming, the other piece is, you know, how about checking our own bias. I love the piece Dr. Parker said about, like, really, I talk to myself all the time. I challenge myself all the time, because at any given moment, the society we live in can shift my wonderful analysis. And when I say that, meaning that as a, when you think about, I lost my train of thought, I'm sorry, but when you think about, you know, how you approach people, how we trust people, I like to think I have a wonderful one with a vision. The HA has a wonderful relationship with the School of Social Work. We, for the last, five, six, maybe 7 years, have had a social work intern. And they know what kind of intern we want. They know what kind we don't want, and we've worked it out. If you are coming, and I ask people when I interview them, if you're coming to One with a Vision because you saw a story or you read something and you want to come and save. And I've had students come in. I've had mostly students who come in and say, well, I just think she should. And my question to the student is always, why? Why do you think you know better about this woman's life? Are you living that life? Is there something I need to know? And, you know, I say it snarky like that, but it's real. Like, why do we think we know best about how somebody is living their life? We're successful because we trust trans women to be able to tell me what she needs as a trans woman. I think we're successful because for women who are involved in all levels of sex work, we actually will hold a meeting, buy food, and sit down and say, so what do you think about this issue that's happening and how do you think we should address it? It's not that we're not without thought and we don't act by our experience of how we need to handle certain things, but I would like to lead by thinking I'm leading the organization, but I am working with my community. That's the biggest thing you have to ask yourself. Just because you have multiple degrees or any of those things and you read a book, it does not mean you know what it's like to wake up in the morning and be a woman who's HIV positive and have a whole slew of medication to take, but I have to go to work, but this med makes me sick. I have five kids, or I'm a positive woman who wants to have a child. Just because I'm HIV positive does not mean I don't have and can't access reproductive rights and justice, right? All of those things are things that when you are challenging yourself about what to do, is really asking yourself the question about how do I do it and why do I feel this way? That's how people, I think that's the biggest, what I see is the biggest mistake when people come into One with a Vision is they're like, I'm coming in and I'm going to save these people. And if they're from anywhere else other than the South, then it becomes all the things wrong with the South and I'm from New York. And I'm going to tell you how it goes. I've been to New York many times, people. And for those of you who know, y'all have wrong stuff there. So it really is, you know, I don't know how I can plead with you, beg with you, or encourage you to sit with yourself. It's something my grandmother used to tell me all the time. She was like, well, if you don't know, go sit with yourself. Like, I'm not going to tell you. I was like, how would you not want to tell me? And she was like, because it's really about you. Like, sitting down and talking to yourself offers you so much if you ever really sit and do that. Just how you see yourself in the world. How do you want to see, like, I feel like I finally figured out at almost 50 how I see the world and how I want to fit in it. I love the idea about what kind of trees you're going to plant now. Like we always say at One with a Vision, what are we doing now that when I am no longer here, when I don't exist, when my 8-year-old granddaughter is doing, hopefully, her and my grandson are doing amazing things, that if they didn't get it from society, then some way they listened to Mama, and Mama laid down the law about what they should have and what they should be able to hold is true for themselves. And that's why it's such a big thing to question yourself. Why do you want to come to an organization that has predominantly black women who lead the organization, but more importantly, who are serviced at this organization? That's not always a comfortable thing for people. And so I asked those in interviews, have you ever worked for a black woman before? And people may think, what kind of question is that? But sometimes for some young white women, it's difficult because they've never been in that position. And I acknowledge that it could be different if you've never had it, because it's easy to take direction from a man, and he could be any color, than it would be from me. Sit with yourself, girl. Don't start off with alcohol first. Sit with yourself.